Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, covering the cultures of consciousness. Well, I think everyone would be in agreement that this year, the issue of race, and particularly African Americans in America, has really exploded and is leaking into the mass mind, leaping out of the political unconscious into the all-too-present consciousness of Twitter streams, op-eds, fear, anger, and the whole panoply of events that I need not bring people up to date on. However, it was very interesting this last week to see in light of the terrible shootings in Charleston, the debate moved towards the issue of the Confederate flag. Now, I'm not going to get into this particular issue. What interests me, and I think is more important to pay attention to, is how, when faced with the incredible difficulty of issues of race in America, the institutional racism, the historical legacy, the incapacity to deal with it for many actors across the board, that we switch the debate to discussing a symbol, because there's something safer about that. There's something that relieves our anxiety and our lack of knowing, our frustration, our fear in having an argument about a symbol. So everyone can kind of line up in the sort of fairly predictable relationships to this question of the value of the Confederate flag as a symbol. And as I was thinking about this and kind of disappointed once again to see the way that arguments about symbols and representations can take the place of more difficult conversations about emotions and about structures and about historical legacies, while they're important, there is a certain diverging factor that I think is a little bit troubling, but it also made me start to think more about symbols in general and how we explore the realm of symbols, of archetypes, of images, of allegories, and how those places have things to say about how we deal with issues of race, issues of identity, issues of historical consciousness. So while I'm not particularly interested in going into that debate, simply because there's so much of it right now, and I think it's something that requires a lot of subtlety to arrive at something new to say, I believe that will be informing subtly our discussion today, which is about, well, we'll see exactly what it's about, but it begins with the notion of particularly powerful symbols and symbol systems, such as the ones we find within esotericism, and the important recognition, which we've talked about recently on the show, that the heritage of esoteric, magical, occult, mystical symbolism that is one of our, concerns here on Expanding Mind, has within it, at least in America, a very, very powerful vein of African-American consciousness, awareness, creativity, expression, et cetera, and that indeed the question of the mysteries or the occult in the United States is inextricable from that particular history. And regular listeners will know that a couple months ago we had Stephen Finley on the show talking about the book he edited on esotericism in African American religious experience. It was a totally fascinating conversation, and it's worth listening to if you haven't checked it out. And the book was really great, but my favorite essays in the book were by a fellow who turns out I had met, though I'd forgotten, a couple years earlier, a fellow named Marcus Redd. And he wrote one piece about Sun Ra's astro-black mythology and another piece about Ishmael Reed's wonderful early 70s novel Mumbo Jumbo, which really stands up there with Gravity's Rainbow and the Illuminatus trilogy from Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea in terms of a crazy early 70s esoteric political visionary rants and marvelous extrusions of the of the American imagination. And so I was incredibly happy to read these two articles. I wanted to read one section from Marcus's piece about Sun Ra, where he says, "Blackness is something the world does not know, is not simply a sociological category, and cannot be comfortably assimilated into standard sociopolitical ideas about race or racial hierarchy. It is a divine cosmic principle of the universe, a living spirit that transmits its vitalism. Embodying rhythm, harmony, and melody is fundamental to the energetic operation of the universe, providing the proper coordination for the multiplicity of elements that compose it and the proper foundation for the enlightenment of those elements. For Sun Ra, blackness is a multidimensional symbol simultaneously encoding information about the formation of the cosmos, human life, and the human psyche, and linking these domains through analogy." And that's part of what I'm talking about here, is that even as we wrestle with the concrete facts of blackness in America and the contrary symbols that get mixed up in that debate and that get, you know, create so much dissension, that we must give blackness its full cosmic due as well. And that's why I think these stories are equally important to our political moment, even if they do not take the form necessarily of explicit political action and rest in the symbolic zone as well. I was also interested in another thing in Marcus's other essay at the very end of his marvelous discussion of Ishmael Reed, and the wonderful mumbo jumbo and its own fascinating history of esotericism that that is included in that book. Marcus talks about how at the end of the day you can only do so much with this material in academia, writing as a, you know, someone who earned his PhD studying the history of images of Egypt in the United States and through culture and consciousness. But there's only so far you can go in this game, and he talks about stepping out of the academic game and attempting to explore, or as he put it, reconstitute the limbs of Osiris to see if it is possible to synthesize and live by all the spiritual science of which the ancient Egyptians were masters. So this movement from scholarship into experience and practice and back again, I think, is a really key part of how we wrestle with the mysteries these days. So I really wanted to have Marcus on the show, and he was grateful enough to come along. And so I think we're going to have a very interesting conversation. So Marcus, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's definitely an honor and a pleasure to be here to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, and so let's start out talking about your studies. You studied you did a number of research projects based on Egypt in the sort of European and American imagination. Fascinating topic, something I don't know a huge amount about. I know a little bit about it. I remember one little bit. I went to Yale, and at Yale there's a marvelous old cemetery called Grove Street Cemetery, and it has an Egyptian gate, and I think it's from about the 1870s. So it's fairly early in that sort of wave of late 19th century Egyptomania that marked America and Europe. And it always sort of puzzled me in the sense of, you know, for me, I look at it and it brings up a sense of mystery, a sense of the occult, of arcane mysteries, of ancient ways that we don't quite understand. But I had no idea of, like, what would this have meant to the people who built it in the, you know, in the 19th century in this, you know, university town in the northeast of the United States. So I'd love to hear a little bit about, you know, what drew you to this topic, but really some of the things you found out about this very important, you know, symbolic universe in American and European consciousness.
Sure. Okay. I can jump right in. I mean, there's so many things I would like to say, but I would start with saying that Egypt has been a topic that has always been an obsession of mine ever since I was in high school, going to the public library every day after school for about 2 or 3 hours a day. I would walk up and down the aisles and see these gorgeous, extra large books about Egypt and all of the images of the pyramids and all of the treasures and the material splendor of the culture. And I think something from that early moment became an inspiration to me to want to understand what this culture brought to a certain kind of human tradition. So when I was at Harvard as an undergrad, I took this budding interest in Egypt, but I just started to see it everywhere. And all of the literature I was reading from every period, from antiquity to the present, I was seeing all kinds of engagements from the Bible to Greco-Roman culture. And I wanted to wrestle with what that influence meant for thinking about the history of the Western tradition and the way in which people have had this strange fascination with Egypt, but also this urge to repress it or call it something foreign, primitive, and other. So I started my research actually with Plato, and which was an odd choice for someone who was majoring in African American studies. But again, as I was reading Plato, and I noticed in all of the late dialogues, the Timaeus, the Critias, the Phaedrus, the Republic, the Laws, Plato has this interesting push and pull relationship to Egypt where he finds that the cultural legacy of that place is so overwhelming that he has to grapple with it in some way for his own philosophical project. So I started by trying to piece out what he was doing and what the kind of specific lines of that influence meant. Once I graduated, I went into studying English literature in particular and ended up jumping much further ahead in historical time, where I was looking at influences of Egypt in America in the 19th century, but also British Romanticism. And I think that moment is a very important moment for this kind of discussion for many reasons. So on one hand, in the late 1790s, we had Napoleon who invaded Egypt. So for the first time, a lot of the monumental artifacts were taken out of the country and were taken to museums around America, in New York, in England, in France. So we had an overwhelming engagement, I mean, where we had people had to deal with the monumental artifacts that were coming in and really trying to understand it, especially in light of the kind of global slavery that was going on. So, I mean, the idea was that, okay, well, we have all of these black cultures who are slaves and who are participating in the global economy in the register of slavery, but now we're seeing this African culture with all of these tremendous, very obviously high cultural accomplishments. I mean, so you have, okay, not only the artifacts coming in post-Napoleon, but you have hieroglyphics that are deciphered for the first time in hundreds and hundreds of years. So we have the early 1800s, Champollion actually being able to penetrate these texts. So while before we had this engagement with Egypt that saw hieroglyphics as these mystical symbols, but nobody really knew how to read them. So now for the first time, people actually had some entree into understanding the life world of this culture.
And it's of course also interesting to think about at that moment, I mean, again, the way in which knowing something about esotericism and the occult, even though it seems like kind of a fringe topic, actually puts you at the heart of a lot of historical currents and conflicts that in this same period, there is also this emergence within the stream of Freemasonry and other fraternal societies that have, you know, certain degrees of interest in occult mysteries, or at least in the theater and performance of these kinds of imaginaries, that you have also a growing obsession with Egypt as a sort of imaginal site of ancient mysteries, of something earlier than Greece, something more primordial, something more ancient and in some ways exotic, but in some ways something that was imagined to be current in some ways within these fraternal orders. And of course, we all could also talk about the beginnings of Mormonism and how Joseph Smith had his own relationship, very, very imaginary, very not rooted in the actualities of Egyptian language, but was also the growth of Mormon, the emergence of Mormonism is also marked by this kind of Egyptian imaginary. So it seems like that Egypt is a place both to think of it's like a way of thinking of a connection or a kind of continuity, a sort of secret continuity. But at the same time, as you're talking about, obviously it's also playing into some larger imaginary about Africa and what Africa means and what Africa would mean at a time of the slave trade. And so it's a very strange, charged symbol.
Very true. Very true.
So what other zones were you seeing it sort of play out, and particularly in light of the way that Egypt would change its symbolic register for the West and also for African Americans, particularly in the 20th century? How did things start to shift in this sort of 19th century zone as we start to get more information about Egypt? More sense of what was actually happening, but at the same time, it still retains this tremendous imaginative power.
Sure. Okay. So I would say, to speak specifically about the African American case, so in thinking about the place of African Americans in this culture in particular, one thing that has been very important is combating very oppressive Eurocentric canons of knowledge. So the standard line in most Eurocentric intellectual history is that human culture, the flourishing of the highest elements of human culture, come from the specific elements brought to bear by the Greek tradition, which brings this miracle of rationalism, and this Abrahamic monotheistic tradition, which brings this ethical version of religion, which is very new in human history. So according to these kinds of ideologies, culture is basically the playing out of the synthesis and the combat between this Greek or Greek or Roman classical tradition on one hand and the Abrahamic tradition on the other. And everything else becomes excised from the sphere of history. So we could think about even people like Hegel and Kant, who created these magnum opuses that try to think about synthesizing all world knowledge and world culture. I'm basically saying, okay, well, there's nothing of value in Africa. Africans are stupid. Africans are outside of the reign of history. And we have African Americans in this country who are basically trying to grapple with this kind of framework. So what Egypt allows on one hand is the argument of saying, even on its own terms, this construction of intellectual history is false. Even if we take this kind of Greek versus Abraham line, we could see that both poles of this spectrum only come into existence through their very bizarre, interesting engagement with Egypt. So, I mean, monotheism being a very interesting case in point, because that monotheistic frame is built primarily around a rejection of Egyptian polytheism. So when we get, for example, let's say the Ten Commandments, one of the most important commandments is thou shalt not have any other gods before me. So what gods are they talking about? Obviously, because they are in Egypt, we're talking about repressing Egyptian gods, repressing Egyptian culture as a foundation for a certain kind of Hebraic monotheism to live. And even in my work on Plato, I mean, there is the same thing. I mean, you actually can't read the classical tradition. I mean, every writer within that tradition, every major writer is engaged in this, in his own appropriation or engagement with Egypt, from Herodotus, Aeschylus, Euripides, Plato. So even when we talk about the greatness of Greece, I mean, one cannot understand it without thinking about its influence by Egypt. And in Plato's case in particular, you have this very bizarre abstraction from Egyptian myth and this kind of removal of Egyptian myth from this larger contextualized ritual framework. So even in that philosophical project, I mean, we can see Egypt is there. So on one hand, like I'm saying, this deployment of Egypt says, okay, even on your own terms, this model is faulty, but also turning to Egypt helps us create another narrative for the future. And I think that's where someone like Sun Ra comes in, because looking at Egypt, using Egypt as an orienting framework and as an origin point, allows us to kind of think of a framework that can synthesize all a panoply of human cultures more easily and think about our place in this larger global planetary framework.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that always struck me, and again, when I started to do my own studies in the history of religion, and particularly the history of esoteric or hermetic ideas in the ancient world, you know, one is inevitably drawn towards Alexandria, this Egyptian city, Greco-Roman city that is a mixture of Greco-Roman forces and Egyptian and forces and all sorts of, it's a crossroads, you know, there's Buddhists there, there's people from all over, it's this cosmopolitan zone, but the fact that it's in Egypt and that a lot of these mysteries are playing off of indigenous magical traditions associated with Egyptian temples, with Egyptian magical work, going back to the pyramid texts, et cetera, you know, it really kind of, again, proves the point that to really have, to open up to this imagination of the West, of the whole Western tradition, you have to go back to a much more mixed and African situation, albeit a kind of, you know, colonialist city in Africa, but it's much more mixed than what you imagine with the sort of, you know, vision of the you know, Greek temples in Athens and the sort of purity of Greece as it was sort of reimagined later on, that we're sort of in the mixture from the get-go, and that feels a lot like now. I mean, Alexandria feels more like where we are now in so many ways than a lot of other zones in the kind of ancient world as just sort of an imaginative kind of template. But I am curious to talk a little bit more about Sun Ra, since you were writing about him, wrote some interesting stuff there. So how does he kind of figure into the ways in which we can think of how Egypt becomes a source of meaning, becomes a source of possibility particularly for African Americans in America in you know in a very racist period?
Oh, that's a great question. So Sun Ra, just for those who don't know, was a major jazz artist who came into prominence in the 1950s, 1960s. He is very different from the standard mold of what we think of as the archetypal jazz musician, like the John Coltrane, the Miles Davis. Sun Ra had a very flamboyant, one, self-presentation. He's always dressed in these homemade costumes, full of pageantry and color and these kinds of space age materials and images all wrapped up into a melange. And he put on these full sensory shows where you not only had music, but also lights and dance and ritual performance. And he brought this kind of multi-discipline art practice to the jazz sphere. And he also ended up writing tons of poetry that he would publish in print and circulate, let's say, in the jackets of his records, but also written or spoken chants that would be added to the music and the performance. So just to kind of give people a sense of who Sun Ra was, just in case they don't know. But one thing that really strikes me about Sun Ra, and I was just hinting at this, is just the completeness of his practice. And one thing about esotericism, especially that differentiates it from the kinds of constructions of knowledge we are familiar with from the Western Academy, there's an attempt to think about holism. There's an attempt to think about large cosmological frameworks that integrate all areas of knowledge, as opposed to disciplines that are fractured and separated from each other with no articulated connections between them. So with esotericism and Sun Ra's esoteric practice, there's an attempt to bring all knowledges, all sciences together into this form of knowledge that is directed towards deepening and spiritualizing consciousness and really transforming the human into something transhuman and divine. So Sun Ra was working not only in the realm of music, but like I said, also in literature, also in art, through the staging of his performances, also in the fields of religion and philosophy and science, and even thinking about his daily life practice, where he lived almost in this commune-style kind of situation with other people in his band, so that there wasn't a sense of this alienated art practice where, you know, I, the genius, come on stage and perform, but all of the performances are not only rituals, but are woven into the fabric of the rituals of his everyday life and the everyday life practice of his group.
I mean, in a way, what you're pointing out is how partly because there is an enigma in Egypt and partly because there is a lot of knowledge in Egypt, and those two are kind of, you know, in tension, that it becomes a remarkably rich place for both groups and individuals who want to try to build a holistic alternative to what's provided in, you know, mainstream American culture, meaning not just a place to tell a story or to get a religious practice or to get a philosophical idea or to get a god, but a more of a multidimensional zone that can speak to and respond to the need for a full-bodied re-inhabiting of the world. And so with Sun Ra, you get that sense. On the one hand, he's very grounded in actual practice, the records he's making and putting out with his band, where they're living together, they're moving around. There's a very strong sense of place, and at the same time, there's a kind of weird sense of being dislodged or nomadic. Like he's in another zone. He's somehow built his own world or a kind of collective world, and it's sort of partly through Egypt that that's able to happen. And that's where we get into this thing. I'd like to, you know, go in this direction that Sun Ra also takes us in, is how Egypt becomes part of a cosmic, particularly a cosmic imaginary, outer space, UFOs, right, the future as much as the past. And that's very powerful. We all recognize that. We see, like, you see Egyptian imagery and UFOs, and you're like, yeah, that totally makes sense. But why? You know, so there's something in that also that I'd love to hear your opinion on.
Yes, I would say several things. So on one hand, I think for Sun Ra, and this is me extricating some implications from his work, but I think for Sun Ra, the interesting thing about African-American culture is that it's really one of the first modern cultures. So if we think about earlier periods, there is, when we think about human culture, I mean, it is kind of located with a certain kind of physical space, a certain kind of language, certain kinds of religious structures that unify that culture. But with African Americans in particular, because of the horror of the slave trade and the way in which people were taken from so many different specific tribes and thrown into this new amalgam, what we have in the African American culture in particular is a community or group of people, let's say, without a unifying language, without a particular landmass to call their own, without particular knowledge of family genealogies and family histories, because that's been taken, without unifying cultural rituals, because now we have people from different cultures. And of course, on one hand, the kind of racist ideology is that, okay, well, coming into our Christian Western white framework will civilize you and bring you up to bear on what culture is. I think Sun Ra takes the opposite tack and says, okay, well, look, we have a culture or a community that is without nation and without language. But instead of looking at this tragically, we can flip this story such that the African-American experience can become a paradigm of a new, more global experience, a more universal experience, because now we can think about planetary belonging as opposed to these earlier frameworks of language, ethnicity, family, bloodline, lineage. So I think by the turn to outer space, the turn to the cosmic, I think part of what Sun Ra is doing is saying that because we have no quote-unquote earthly land or earthly place, we can use African-American culture as a paradigm for thinking about the human, more broadly human relationship to the larger cosmos, to the larger world. I would say that's one argument, but then I would say on another hand, by using this language of outer space, of moving into the space age, I think Sun Ra also reminds us of how important astronomy, shamanic astronomy, astrology has always been to African cultures, particularly in ancient Egypt. All of the project of that culture is really trying to think about how to synchronize terrestrial life, human life, with larger forms of cosmic life. And really, there's this idea that all cosmic movements, movements of the sun, the stars, the moon, other kind of planetary bodies, all of these movements are really just the visible manifestation of divine forces. So the goal of the culture is to bring us in line with a larger kind of universal movement. So, for instance, you have the Sphinx that's constructed to be looking due east so that when the sun rises on, let's say, the equinoxes, the Sphinx is staring directly in that position. Or when you have temples that are constructed to catch certain rays of starlight on specific power moments of the calendar, when you have rituals that are timed to be in sync with the full moons and things of that sort, or the rising of Sirius. So I think Sun Ra is doing both. He's reminding us of how important and how sophisticated African cosmologies have always been about keeping us in sync with our kind of human bodily rhythms with the larger cosmic rhythms that are all around us, and drawing strength and power and divinity from that synchronicity, but also saying that this move into outer space is a specific kind of heritage that African-American culture can provide for the whole world.
Yeah, and just to sort of wrap it up about Ra is just how much you can immerse yourself in these ideas, invitations, encounters, even through listening, engaging with his music. I mean, the way that you say, you know, people, you know, seek out mystical understanding by reading books or reading about, you know, practices or the histories of gods or mythologies, that music functions as this sort of nonverbal language or nonverbal expressive universe that really brings you in resonance with some of these larger, you know, larger ideas. And I think that's part of the appeal of Sun Ra, and why a lot of people, you know, fall in love with him as a way of kind of encountering maybe a way of being in the world that's a little bit hard to get to in a strictly, you know, intellectual fashion, just through reading or just through, you know, thinking about things. It's right there for you to listen to.
Oh, for sure. And so much of Sun Ra's work has to do with this idea of harmonics and the importance of harmonics, and not just in the musical sense, but really thinking about reality itself. I mean, there's such a deep physics in Sun Ra that hasn't really been fully explicated. But in Sun Ra's understanding, reality itself becomes a different register of harmonics. We all are different kinds of vibrations. There's nothing that is solid. Everything is vibrating in some way, shape, or form. So Sun Ra's music becomes a tool or a technique, a very scientific technique, for putting us back in tune. Those sounds and those tones are meant to reorient us and to really change our way of thinking so that we can perceive things that we couldn't perceive before hearing those tones.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk more about stuff, but we got to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Marcus Redd about Egypt and Afro-Black mythology, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. Today we're talking with Marcus Redd about Afro-Black mythology and the delicious question of Egypt. So I'm, you know, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Marcus, I'm really very interested to hear about how you know, an excellently educated Harvard graduate with a very clear set of interests and undoubtedly a good desirability on the academic job market, decided to step away from your studies and to dive into some of these practices, particularly into the question of how and why and to go about actually engaging with ancient Egyptian religion in our modern period, when there's so much, you know, there's so many ideas about what that might mean, and yet you're also entering into a stream of people who have been trying to figure this stuff out for a long time. So I'd just love to hear about your own shift of exploration into these matters, taking them outside of the subject-object relationship of academia into a sort of participation mode of engaging these questions.
Oh, that's a great question. And I think I would probably have to quote my friend Victoria Nelson, and she's written also on a lot of esoteric matters. She says, the more you study esotericism, I mean, it's a danger because you know, if you dip your toe into that pool, you might end up falling in. And I think in my own experience, I have come to agree with her. I mean, in the sense that if you study esotericism properly, it is hard to not become more of an esotericist. So just to give a little bit more about my background. So like we said, I graduated from Harvard, got my PhD from UC Berkeley, and then became a professor. And I was teaching English literature for about 3 years. And it was interesting because I was trying to find a way to bring these two different worlds together. And I noticed that there was just a major tension in not only in the way knowledge is organized, let's say in the contemporary academy and in more esoteric spaces, but the aims of education seem to be very different. So on one hand, if we think about the conventional academy, there's a real focus only on external perception and the external surface of things. So you only get to talk about things, but not really experience them. I mean, so we can talk about, let's say, the history of astrology or the constructions of Gnosticism, but we can't actually use those things, or we can't actually engage with their knowledge claims and dive into them on a personal basis. It's all about pouring information into the student externally, accumulating external facts. Okay, you need to learn this history, these paradigms, these concepts. Whereas when you think about esotericism, it's a very different approach to education. It really goes to the root of what the word education means. I mean, education comes from the Latin words educare, basically meaning to draw from within, to move out from within. And I think in esoteric practice, the goal is very much taking what's internal to the student and making it explicit, taking what's latent and waking it up, in a sense, learning about the larger macro universe through studying the self and the body. So it's a very different approach to knowledge. It's not about accumulating facts. It's not about external paradigms, but it's really about finding ways to hone in on consciousness, purify consciousness, and spiritualize it. So, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm just kind of curious, you know, I mean, what was happening in you, what was happening in your life that made you go, look, I mean, I'm sorry, I got to dive in. You know, it's like, I can see how this logic works and it's not enough right now. And you know, both with an eye towards your own experience, your own needs, your own interests, but also, and I think this is in some ways more important, with an eye towards changing the way we study things, changing the way we think and write about esotericism or about these matters of you know, mystical consciousness and these vast traditions full of oddities and eccentricities and marvels and real inspirations.
Well, I think on one hand, it was through random meetings with people that I think pushed me to do this. So I guess on one hand, as I was studying Egypt, I did find myself wanting to see what it might be like to actually engage with these traditions from the perspective of a practitioner. And when I was in California studying for my PhD, I did almost randomly or magically come into contact with a group of people who were practicing Santeria, which is a Afro-Cuban tradition that has now migrated to America. And it was a very interesting attempt in the New World to reconstitute certain forms of Yoruba cosmology into a religious practice that could fly under the radar of explicit slavery. So by finding people who were practicing a living African tradition, I actually found that I understood what was going on in Egypt much more. I mean, so when you see, let's say, an Oshun ritual, all of a sudden, all of the narratives and myths of Heteru and Ahi become just much more clear. They have a certain kind of depth and power and richness that they didn't necessarily have before when you're just kind of reading them from an academic perspective. And I think at a certain point, I just had come to a crossroads in the sense that I had been thinking so deeply about these questions And as I was working on the Sun Ra piece and the Ishmael Reed piece, I mean, as I kept following them to their logical conclusions, I mean, it became a question of, okay, well, how do I make this academic quest work? I mean, it's interesting because Sun Ra had his own very complicated relationship to the academy as well. I mean, he was offered a teaching position at UC Berkeley. I mean, that's an interesting personal connection, but at UC Berkeley in the late 60s, early 70s, where he was allowed to teach a seminar, and it flouted so many of the rules of traditional academic approaches to things that he was very quickly dismissed from the academy. And he very explicitly stated that his way of being, his mode of perceiving the world, could not fit into the space. And even if you take, let's say, a small form of the larger esoteric tradition like astrology, I mean, where exactly does it fit? I mean, is it history of science? Is it psychology? Is it philosophy? Is it sociology? Is it art history? Is it religion? Is it literature? I mean, so the moment you bring these other kinds of knowledge or these other approaches to knowledge and spirituality into the academy, the disciplinary lines automatically break down and explode. And I think I realized, even though I was teaching in an English department, I was not wedded to a certain kind of construction of knowledge. I mean, I knew I was fascinated by Egypt, and I wanted to talk about what Egypt meant in the history of human culture, what kinds of influences it's had, how we can think about organizations of knowledge differently. But yet I was forced to navigate through this very circumscribed framework. And so I figured, you know, I mean, I had other kinds of projects, entrepreneurial and business projects I wanted to work on as well. So I figured, you know, I'm young enough. Let me just go out on a limb and see if I can take a little bit of time off to experience these kinds of things for myself so that I could move from, on one hand, this extreme left-brained approach to these matters to a more right-brained, connective, experiential approach.
And so you moved to a hotbed of energy, Sedona, Arizona.
Yes. I mean, I think out of all places in the country to move to, I mean, that is definitely the place to go if you are a person on a spiritual mission. I mean, there's such a diversity of people and perspectives that you find there. I mean, all kinds of Tibetan monks and psychics and astrologers of all stripes and spiritualists of all stripes. So I think it was a very safe place to engage in exploring all of the different kinds of traditions that are or have been associated with ancient Egypt.
So did you find yourself mostly sort of seeing what other people were doing with the Egyptian material, or did you soon find yourself needing to kind of cobble together your own ritual practices or your own ways of engaging the cosmology or the metaphysics?
Oh, no, I jumped right in. I mean, and there have been so many different attempts from, let's say, from the 1970s to think about how to reconstruct Egyptian traditions. So just to back up a little bit. So, of course, in the 1960s, we had the civil rights movement and really one of the first times where African-American communities were mobilizing en masse to end or at least to fight against a certain kind of racial terror. So we know about, through popular media, Martin Luther King and the Christian response to Jim Crow and these kinds of things, but there were other kinds of responses at that moment as well. And particularly, you had many groups of people who were interested in trying to reconstruct and rebuild African traditions in order to think through, okay, how can we build our own autonomous cultures in order to craft a new future for ourselves and our communities? So, for example, you had a figure, or you had an experiment like Oyatunji in South Carolina that was formed in the 1970s, where you had someone who, an African-American who traveled to Nigeria to become initiated, who came back to this country and recreated an entire Yoruba village, and really tried to restart those kinds of traditions and lineages and give a space for the cultivation of those deities in this particular country. Also in the early 1970s, you had a figure like Ra-un-Nefer-Amen, who started the Asar Aset Society, which was a major attempt to reconstruct ancient Egyptian practice based off of surviving materials and also using kind of ritual frameworks in order to recover through trance what had been lost externally. I definitely wouldn't say that I was the first person by any means to delve into these territories. And I think there have been many kinds of precursors that helped. But I think being in a place like Sedona gave me an opportunity to say, okay, well, let me systematically start exploring things like divination, shamanic astronomy, the practice of sacred geometry, meditating with glyphs, dream interpretation, ancestor communication, numerology, aromatherapy, certain kinds of yoga and herbalism. I mean, being in that space helped me to say, okay, now that I'm here, now that I have this time, okay, let me put forth a good effort to jump in and see what happens.
And I mean, yeah. And so what did happen? I mean, how much did you feel yourself, let's say, how would I characterize this? Something about, there's something interesting that seems to happen with spiritual practice, and particularly when you're inviting a kind of imaginative dimension, symbolic dimension, dream material, something beyond the spareness, let's say, of just doing a straight, meditation breathing practice. But when you're really kind of inviting the kind of mysterious or esoteric element of it, there's definitely the sense that it kind of has a life of its own. And what that life is not always particularly clear. And yet there definitely seems to be some kind of unfolding, as if there's already a kind of narrative that's happening. And I'm curious whether for you it took the form of many different things happening in a very networked kind of multiplicity way, because there were so many different things you were looking at, or whether it came to like it began to boil down into a very particular thread that was really leading you forward.
Oh, that's a fascinating question. I think what I would say is I feel that if anything else, there was a sense in which a new kind of paradigm was asking to be reborn. I guess I was seeing the depth of so many of these practices in ways that I don't think the academy has yet to catch up on. And I guess I was seeing how, again, thinking about Sun Ra and this attempt to form new paradigms, and Sun Ra, the word he uses is mythocracy. So I'm trying to take something that seems mythical but bring it into reality. So it's almost a sense in which a tradition was asking to be reborn, in a sense. I guess to be a little more concrete, so I think one thing that I really found fascinating about Egypt is that spiritual practice was not something that was an isolated individual or personal endeavor, but something that was deeply woven into the fabric of society, and that initiation was constructed for the purpose of uplifting an entire community. So for example, if you wanted to hold, let's say, a government position in that ancient context, you had to have been a graduate or an initiate of a particular mystery temple. So let's say we have, I guess in our context would be the Department of the Treasury. You had to be initiated to the god of wealth. In order to be in the army, you had to be initiated into the god of war. So that every piece, every directive of the society was guided by a larger divine vision. So there was a real sense in which the personal and the political and the societal were all interwoven into this larger mix. So I think as I was doing this work, I think I just felt called to try to articulate deeper understandings of how important spiritual practice is for reforming and reshaping our kind of larger communal lives.
Okay, that's a great point. We only have a few minutes, but I want to stay on this point, because of course it's really where the sort of, rubber hits the road. Right now there's so much strife. We don't have to go into it. Economic injustice, war, and I have a sense from a lot of people, their people are depressed, they're worried, they're kind of worn down, and it seems more and more that like reality is nasty, brutish, and short, and it's dominated by very real-world political players, and that there's very little room for the kinds of expanded cosmic visions you're talking about. Maybe in the past we can look back and say, yeah, the 70s was a tough time, but it was also a time of a lot of, you know, the creation of new identities and the new kinds of communities, and there was sort of a space to evolve in this way. And now you look at the contemporary New Age, or you look at the way that New Age ideas get absorbed into a predatory capitalism, and it's like, oh God, like, where do we go with this stuff? And yet there does seem to be a fundamental need for this larger expanded view as a way of orienting and of lending hope and lending energy and, you know, God knows, lending the force of the cosmos to some of the concrete struggles that we face. So as you have gone through this work and as you return to academia or whatever form of knowledge work that you're going to do in your life, how do you see integrating this stuff in our society now?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Many answers I could give to that. I mean, I guess to kind of develop a little bit of what you were just saying about how to think about the awfulness of this kind of contemporary moment, I think a particular kind of ancient Egyptian answer would be because of the lack of initiation. So one thing that initiation, and particularly doing all of this esoteric work, is supposed to do is awaken and strengthen higher brain centers. I mean, so we're talking about the pituitary, the pineal systems, the thalamus systems, which are actively dormant in all of us until we actually work to kind of wake up these higher structures. So the problem becomes when you are thinking from the kind of lower kinds of brain structures, the kind of reptilian complex, the mammalian complex, and all of these kind of lower structures in the brain. So, and it's interesting kind of because when we think about esotericism, we don't necessarily think about it from this kind of scientific perspective of saying, okay, you know, we are using very specific techniques to have very specific effects, to have a very specific purpose. But the purpose of these systems is to prevent these very kinds of things that we're describing. I mean, so you don't, you have initiated people, so you don't have these kinds of predatory individuals who are at the helm of governments and economic situations. And I think because there was such an attempt to keep the kind of mechanisms and the reins of society in the hands of people who had met and mastered a certain level of spiritual practice, I think that's why ancient Egypt was able to last for the thousands of years that it did, at least 3,000 years and more. Whereas here in this particular cultural context, I mean, our country hasn't even made it to 400 years, and we're already wondering, okay, how long is this experiment going to last? So I would say the major thing is trying to rebuild institutions so that people can have the very systematic experience of moving from kind of one stage of human accomplishment to higher stages. And only once those kinds of supplementary institutions have been built can we think about changing a larger direction of culture.
Well, great. That's a wonderful task, and we're pretty much out of time here, so we're going to have to leave it at that. And I have no doubt that you will find ways of bringing that into your future work, especially even in the academy. I mean, I think that the education itself is changing so drastically, and our knowledge about the human consciousness and the nature of the brain, and the relationship of the brain and consciousness to our experience of the world is just exploding in a way that there's a lot of room for creative engagement at a time where we really need it. So, Marcus, thanks again for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you as well.
Well, that was great. And from me, Eric Davis, to all you out there, keep your minds open.